iHeart Podcasts. Guess what, Will?
What's that, Mango?
So I know you know this, but my family loves the writer P.G. Wodehouse. Like, his books are light and sweet and funny. And wherever you go in India, you'll find them on my family's bookshelves. And when I was in middle school and high school, there was this great TV adaptation of Worcester and Jeeves. And it had a young Hugh Laurie in it, a young Stephen Fry. And Hugh Laurie played this rich simpleton. His name was Bertie Worcester. He was always getting into silly trouble. And Stephen Fry played his genius butler who was always saving him. And his name was Jeeves. And he was actually a valet.
That is, isn't it pronounced valet, Mango?
Not if you're British, apparently. There it's valet. But it's a gentleman's gentleman. The reason I'm bringing it up is that Jeeves in these stories is the proper one, and he's always shuddering at these like newfangled ideas that Bertie Worcester has. And in this one episode, Bertie gets his pajamas monogrammed, and Jeeves just can't stand this. Like, he thinks it's super low class and tawdry to put your initials on things. And he keeps wondering if it's because, like, Bertie will forget who he is or whether he owns pajamas. So he kind of scoffs at it disapprovingly through the show.
Which is pretty funny because today, you know, if you've got a monogram on a shirt or especially a towel, Mango, I mean, that is seen as like real high class, don't you think?
Towel, definitely. Yeah. So the thing is, there are all these like strange customs and sports and traditions that we sort of revere today as elite and we see them as high class, but actually they started out with much more humble origins. And today on the show, we're going to take all that stuff down a peg, and that's what we're talking about. So let's dive in.
Hey there, podcast listeners. Welcome to Part-Time Genius. I'm Will Pearson, and as always, I'm joined by my good friend Mangesh Hatikader. And on the other side of the soundproof glass, I can't stop looking over at him because he is looking so dapper. He's in a top hat and tails. That is our friend and producer, Tristan McNeil. I don't think I've ever seen him looking so fancy. Have you, Mango?
This dressed up. No, it's amazing.
Oh, man. And as you know, Tristan did say he'd be dressing up as a quote, wealthy elite. That's what he's been saying all week for today's show. So I imagine that's what's going on here.
But it off.
I have to say, I don't know about you. I feel like he looks a little more like a stage magician, maybe, but you know, whatever. I mean, he looks good.
I know. If he had a pack of cards, he could go in one direction. If he had like a monocle and cane, he'd look like Mr. Peanut, which feels like a little less elite to me, but I admire Tristan's style.
Well, to be fair, people have drastically different ideas about what is elite. So you could ask a dozen people on the street and get 12 completely different answers. And, you know, while things like wealth and privilege crop up in most people's definitions, the specifics on how that wealth and privilege are displayed, you know, varied a lot over the years. And things that were once considered elite or high class are now seen as tacky, and things that started out with this more mass appeal of since only been set aside for the rich. And I think it's that second kind of shift that we'll probably focus on today, you know, that lower class things that have sort of graduated to the upper crust. So I feel like this is maybe our Beverly Hillbillies episode, you could say. And so, you know, we're going to check out some of the food, the sports, the cultural norms that started out humbly and later became these symbols of wealth and status. So let's dive right in. You know, Mango, what do you think is your first rags to riches story for the day?
So I thought I'd kick things off with the farmhouse origins of one of the world's fanciest sounding beers. And that, of course, is the Belgian Saison.
Oh, man, that does sound fancy, although maybe that was just your impeccable French accent there, Mango.
I know we pronounce valet, valet. We've got Saison. Yeah. It's pretty amazing. But you could say that Saisons kind of taste kind of fancy, too. Like, they're typically on the dry side in terms of beer. In fact, I was at a wedding some years ago where we drank Saison for the wedding toast instead of champagne. But historically, Saisons were most popular among the working class, and that was true right up until the 1950s when they sort of fell out of favor altogether. And if you cut to today, you know, there's kind of a Saison revolution that's been going on. About a dozen or so craft breweries started it and they started making it again. And of course, the flip side is that the beer is now viewed as kind of niche and not as approachable as it should be to the average drinker.
Well, and I feel like it doesn't help that Saisons aren't served usually in these regular pint glasses. I mean, it feels like they usually come in these wide-stemmed glasses, right? Like a brandy glass or something like that.
Yeah, that can definitely be true. The presentation changes, and sometimes people like to swirl them. But despite the fancy modern reputation, Saisons actually have these really humble roots. So they first came on the scene during the 18th century when they were brewed by farmers in Wallonia, which is, I guess, this French-speaking region of southern Belgium. But rather than being brewed for its taste or its intoxicating effects, Saison began as a product of necessity more than anything else. And that's really because the water in more rural regions wasn't potable at the time. It contained way too many of these pathogens that made it unfit for drinking. So in order to keep their workers hydrated through those busy summer seasons, farmers started brewing Saisons.
All right, but hadn't people been doing that a long time? Like, that's kind of the origin of beer in general, isn't it? I mean, you could go all the way back to ancient Egypt. I think it was fuel for, you know, the laborers there when water was either scarce or contaminated. So I feel like that's something that's been around for a long time.
That's definitely true. And Wallonian farmers definitely weren't the first to have this beer-dependent workforce. The trouble for them was how to keep enough beer on hand to last through the hot summers. And you've got to remember, this was all prior to refrigeration. So getting beer to ferment and not spoil was pretty tricky during the months when heat and all this airborne bacteria was at its peak. So Saisons were kind of the solution to this problem. Like, they were brewed during the cooler autumn and winter months and then stored until summer rolled around. And it's actually from the strong association with the certain time of year that the beer gets its name, since Saison is actually French for season.
Well, I mean, that makes sense, but I'm curious, though, was this beer any different from other kinds being made at the time, or was it just the time of year that made it stand out?
Yeah, Saisons were actually set apart in a few ways. Like, one thing is that they were much hoppier than the other beers, and that's because the hops act as a natural preservative, and they also possess these antiseptic properties, which, again, was super helpful in fighting off those pathogens. The other standout trait is that Saisons were really adaptable. Like, farmers typically used whatever they had on hand at the end of a harvest to make the next year's Saisons. So the base ingredients and the spices varied from farm to farm and even barrel to barrel. Like, these differences made the beer hard to categorize, but it also made it a bit more personal. And since the average farm worker drank as much as, I think it's like 5 liters of Saison every single workday. Whoa. Yeah, I'm guessing they didn't mind a little variety in that flavor.
5 liters a day. I mean, imagine this couldn't have been that alcoholic, right? Unless I'm actually picturing all these farmers just passed out in their fields by noon, but that's crazy.
Yeah, I read that most Saisons were originally around 3% or so, which would be enough to give them a buzz, but, you know, not so strong as to incapacitate them. And of course, the alcohol content went up a little over time as other people began, you know, drinking them too. It wasn't just the workers. In fact, many small farms from the era were eventually turned into family breweries, and the different Saisons became kind of a specialty drink for their respective towns.
All right. So if they were this popular, why did they disappear for a while? Because I think you said they kind of vanished. What was it, in the 50s or so?
Yeah, this was really due to industrialization. So by the 50s, refrigeration and like access to drinkable water, that all eliminated this need for these summer-specific ales. So demand dried up pretty quickly, and what was kind of the de facto beer of the working class became this artisanal product instead. And, you know, even in today's Saisons, you can still find traces of the beer's farmhouse roots because, you know, aside from the notes of fruit and spice, you'll also taste this kind of like earthy funkiness in the brews. And that really harkens back to those like grab bag ingredients that those Wallonian farmers were using. You know, it's kind of funny, like the description that's used for that barnyard flavor is actually horse blanket. Like, horse blanket is supposedly what makes Saison so appealing.
I have to admit that horse blanket isn't generally a flavor I think I would seek out.
You don't get horse blanket Pringles?
Horse blanket. All right. Well, since we're on the subject of elite dining, you know, I do want to talk about lobster for a minute, because this is one of those that I just found super interesting and didn't know a whole lot about before we were researching for the episode. But Believe it or not, there was actually a time when lobster meat was the lowest priced item on a New England menu, and it was about half the cost of chicken, that was pound for pound at least, and five times cheaper than Boston baked beans, of all things.
Cheaper than beans means something, yeah. Right?
Like, yes, it does.
So I actually read that lobsters used to be so abundant on the East Coast, and this was back in the 1600s, that it wasn't uncommon to find like 2 foot high piles of them just washed up on the beach. I mean, that is incredible to think about.
Yeah. And, you know, and people who stumbled on those lobster piles probably left them right where they were, because back then most people wanted nothing to do with lobsters. They were considered disgusting, and, you know, partially because they look like insects and partially because of their reputation as being these bottom feeders. And honestly, none of that is too far off. I mean, lobsters really are distant relatives of cockroaches and spiders. And in fact, their name actually comes from the Old English word lop, which actually means spider.
So I do like lobsters because they're so funny. I'm sure you remember how my roommate in college, Adam, and I wanted to get a pet lobster because
of course
it'd be fun to walk around on a leash. And we even had a name, Hector the Lobster. But of course, that's where our efforts stopped because we didn't really do things. We just talked about things.
It didn't stop you guys from talking about it a lot, though. I remember that.
So I do feel like we give lobsters this giant pass because they live in the ocean, right? Like if you came across a lobster in the forest and saw it climbing out of a hole in the tree, you'd think it was like some kind of giant monster bug. And dipping it in butter would be like the furthest thing from your mind. But, you know, that's even before you get into how weird lobster anatomy is. Like their brains are in their throats, their teeth are in their stomachs. The whole thing is a mess.
I can't argue with you on that. But, you know, as unpopular as lobsters were in the 17th century, some people did eat them anyway. I mean, you look at Native Americans, for instance, they ate lobsters by wrapping them in seaweed and then baking them over hot rocks. But to be fair, lobster wasn't their first choice. I mean, they also used the meat to fertilize their crops and bait their fishing hooks. And they were doing that in hopes of catching something less disgusting than lobster.
Well, you know, some colonists must have eaten them too, right? Like, I know food was scarce in those early days, so I can't imagine everyone had the luxury of being picky.
Well, lobster was plentiful and a solid source of protein, so people did eat it, just not happily and always with a certain degree of embarrassment, I guess, when they were eating it. But, you know, times were tough, and only the wealthiest residents could afford chicken or pork, and that's how lobster became a poor person food. And so, you know, lobsters were a common meal for people like prisoners or apprentices or enslaved people and even cats, Mango. I mean, that's what it was like. And this didn't go over well, of course, except with the cats who weren't as worried about what other people thought. And, you know, some indentured servants actually had a clause in their contract saying that they could be fed lobster no more than 3 times a week. I mean, that's how undesirable it was.
I mean, it's insane because you think of like how people crave lobster today, right?
Yeah, and lobster is one of the top requested last meals for prisoners on death row now. So clearly these perceptions have changed significantly over the years.
So I am curious what sparked that change in thinking, because like going from a trash meat to this like posh delicacy is a pretty big leap, even for something with 10 legs, which, you know, I only just realized they have 10 legs.
What? They had 10 legs?
Yeah, so I've never been counting the claws. I guess they have 2 pinchers and then those like 8 legs beneath. And
yeah,
apparently this is pretty common. Like I saw this piece in Slate that almost every image of a lobster in a cartoon or a drawing, and this is even on road signs for like lobster places,
right,
they all have 8 legs instead of 10. And it's anatomically incorrect everywhere you look. So, you know, I got us off track, but I did want to make a point of that. But
that was... That was very important to talk about, you know, to understand.
Well, now you're going to see it everywhere. But how did lobsters get so fancy? Tell me about that.
All right. Well, it actually all comes down to railroads, believe it or not. So go back to the 1870s, and trains gave rise to the seasonal tourism in America with wealthy residents of places like New York or D.C. They would head off to, you know, to Boston or to Maine to get away from that summer heat. And it was this travel boom that led to a realization for railroad managers, namely, you know, that many passengers were clueless about how hated lobsters were by the people on the coast. And so this allowed the trains to serve up lobster as though it was this kind of like an exotic delicacy, even though it actually cost the railroad much less than other meats would have.
Huh.
And this ruse seemed to work, and passengers soon were heading home from vacation, raving to their neighbors about this delicious boiled lobster that they'd had while they were out on their fancy travels. And so word of mouth grew from there, and lobster canning became a thing, and it actually launched a whole industry around this.
That's pretty incredible. You know, what's interesting about that, though, is it makes it seem like the popular opinion was really the only thing holding lobsters back, right? Like, it's almost like now that there were people who were actually liking eating lobster, it suddenly made the food tastier.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. But there actually was more to it than that, because once there was really a market for lobster, it gave the chefs an opportunity to start experimenting with different preparations. And so you fast forward a bit, and by the 1880s, they'd stumbled across a real game changer. So they discovered that lobster looked more appetizing and tasted a whole lot better if it was actually cooked alive rather than being killed and then cooked. And that's kind of when it went gourmet. So by the 1920s, the demand outweighed supply for the first time in history, and the going rate for lobster rose to about what it is today. Now, that said, lobster was still viewed as food for the poor in Maine and other parts of New England, where, you know, kids were embarrassed to go to school with lobster meat sandwiches. And that really only changed during World War II because lobster wasn't subject to rationing like other forms of protein. And so that meant that people from all regions and social classes began to find out just how tasty these, you know, these sea bugs could be.
So did that egalitarian streak last for long?
No, I mean, by the time the war was over and the 1950s rolls around, lobster had fully become an American delicacy. And this was, you know, obviously seen as a meal fit for movie stars and the 1% rather than the prisoners and the poor people that it had been seen as before.
So we've definitely been talking about this from a New World perspective, but I am curious what Europeans thought. Like, did they hate lobster as much as the North Americans did?
You know, I was looking into that because I actually had no idea. And it seems like there's always been a market for European blue lobster. It's a lot more rare and expensive than the kind that we eat here because, you know, Europeans never had the same reservations about eating them. In fact, it was kind of the opposite. I mean, lobster was believed to have these medicinal qualities during the Middle Ages, even the Renaissance, and it was served pretty often at these upper-class feasts. And in fact, your story about wanting to walk a lobster on a leash actually has a bit of a legacy. Maybe you and Adam have been doing your reading on this, but I was reading about this French poet named Gerard de Nerval, and he supposedly had a pet lobster. And he would sometimes put a leash on it and take it for walks at the Royal Palace in Paris. And, you know, when he got weird looks, he'd respond by saying, quote, "How is a lobster more ridiculous than a dog, a cat, a gazelle, a lion, or any other animal? I have an affinity for lobsters. They're easygoing and serious. They know the secrets of the sea, and they don't bark." So
all
other than
true.
The very last part of that, I don't understand any of that, but I love the quote.
Well, I do feel like I'm in good company, and I like how he's marketing them not just as an elite food, but also as an elite pet.
Absolutely. But now that we've covered fancy food and drink, what do you say we shift a little bit and talk about maybe a couple of athletic pastimes that had more modest beginnings?
Absolutely. But first, let's take a quick break.
You're listening to Part-Time Genius, and we're talking about sports that made the switch from lowbrow to high class. So, all right, Mango, you're up first. What comes to mind when you think about posh sports?
Well, we mentioned this in our Winter Olympics episode, but most of the cold weather sports are still pretty elite.
Yeah.
And that's largely because of the travel costs, the expensive equipment that goes along with sports like skiing or ice skating. But, you know, one sport that seems needlessly elite to me is squash. And it's a little like racquetball. It's a racquet sport, but it's played with this hard ball that you have to warm up. Have you ever seen this?
I've seen it, but I've actually never played.
So the first time I went onto the squash court, I watched this guy just like squishing the ball under his foot and just rolling it vigorously to warm the ball up, because the ball actually doesn't bounce until it's warm. It's pretty ridiculous.
Oh, that's weird. I didn't know that.
Yeah. And they played a lot in India, so I've seen it there. But you know, there's nothing that sophisticated about the sport except where the courts are located. Like, mostly they're in well-to-do neighborhoods or in these sort of elite country clubs.
Which is just where you're hanging out all the time. So it makes sense that you would have played at some point. But, you know, in our Titanic episode, we mentioned that the ship actually had its own regulation squash court for those first class passengers. And I feel like that's a pretty good testament to the game's reputation as being this elite sport. But since you're bringing it up today, I'm guessing squash didn't start out quite so fancy.
Definitely not. So I do want to clarify, in Brooklyn, in Borham Hill, there's a New York sports club. You can rent a squash court for $5. So you can get on the squash court for very cheap.
I like how worried you are that people are going to think you're just hanging out at country clubs.
I can't get into country clubs. So squash was actually derived from this game called rackets, which, you know, had been invented by prisoners in the early 19th century. And the inmates at this Denner's prison in London started getting their exercise by hitting a ball against the prison walls with tennis rackets. And from there, the game sort of spread beyond the prison, with many of England's lower class citizens playing it in the alleyways behind pubs. And then the game spread to schools, where the first four-wall courts were specifically built just for the game. And it was at one of these schools where students invented a spin-off rackets game called squash. And I guess rackets was played with this hard, hollow rubber ball that tends to be pretty predictable, you know, when bounced off a wall, while the squash ball is so much softer, and it really makes for a greater variety of shots.
So what made the students switch to the softer ball? Like, were the schools seeing it as a safety thing with the harder balls, or what?
You know, that's what I was wondering at first, but it turns out the switch happened more organically. So this was in around the 1830s. Students at Harrow School in London realized that rackets was much, much more challenging when you played with a punctured ball, because it just became like harder to predict where the ball would bounce. And you had to pay closer attention, you had to run around the court more, and you weren't just waiting for it to bounce back to you. And the squeezable ball became sort of the defining feature of their game. And that's supposedly where the sport, you know, got its name, from the way the ball kind of squashes on impact with the wall.
Oh, that makes sense. That's pretty cool. And I'm guessing that the new game kind of took off. I mean, you don't hear too much about rackets these days, but squash does still seem pretty popular.
Yeah, I mean, it was so popular that it eclipsed its parent sport by the early 20th century. And while squash now has this reputation of being sort of an upper crust sport, it is worth noting that more than 25 million people play squash in 185 different countries. And that includes a good deal of underprivileged kids, too. Like there's this one program out in Harlem called Street Squash, and they promote the sport as kind of a youth enrichment program in low-income communities. This is in New York, New Jersey, and around that area. But the kids not only, like, develop hand-eye coordination and teamwork, but they get a pretty good workout. You know, part of the reason I picked up squash is that, you know, just 45 minutes of playing is really, really intense. Actually, I have the stats here. Well, 1 hour of squash can burn between 600 and 1,000 calories, and that puts it well above the calorie count for most other sports.
Oh, that's really interesting. All right, well, I want to talk about another exercise, and it was an elite exercise that developed in a British internment camp, believe it or not. Now, this was back during World War I. This was when the British government began to worry about German-born residents and that they might defect and become German soldiers if they were deported from England. So instead, all these German men between the ages of 17 and 42 were just rounded up and sent to these camps throughout the country. Now, one of these camps, there was a German boxer and just kind of all-around great athlete, and his name was Joseph Pilates. And he had been pulled away from his life working for a British circus. Now, you can probably guess that during his time in the camp, the fitness system that he created, it actually helped improve the lives of countless fellow inmates.
So I'm curious, like, Pilates was created at an internment camp? Because, like, you know, that's way more intense than I ever would have expected. You know, obviously today we see Pilates as kind of like this yuppie activity and a way for movie stars to flatten their stomachs. But how did Pilates convince these people at the camp to start doing stretches and controlled breathing exercises?
You know, believe it or not, it didn't take that much convincing. I mean, the camp they were at was severely overcrowded, and so much so that it eventually required its own railroad just to handle the influx of detainees. And
wow.
As you can imagine, these conditions and the general indignity of their situation, it drove a lot of inmates to depression. So many of them honestly kind of lost the will to live and quickly found themselves bedridden or even hospitalized in many cases. But the sight of this suffering really struck a chord in Pilates. And as a child, he'd been incredibly sickly. He'd racked with everything from asthma and rickets to rheumatic fever. And this made him a natural target for bullies who made his life really unpleasant as an adolescent. And the way Pilates recovered was devoting his life to fitness. So he took up gymnastics and bodybuilding, martial arts, you name it, the guy did it all. And his rehabilitation went so well that by the age of 14, he was so buff and so fit that he was asked to pose for anatomical charts. And anyway, it's pretty amazing. But when Pilates saw the other men in the camp in such dire straits, he decided to try and help them through the same means that he had helped himself.
That's pretty amazing. So had he already developed all these exercises, or were they something he came up with specifically in the camp?
Well, I think that emphasis on breathing and core strengthening was already in place, but he also came up with new techniques. Like, he'd noticed the way certain animals perform these fluid stretching movements while they're lying down, and it made him wonder, like, if the same moves could be applied to those who were stuck in bed. So to that end, Pilates gathered some straps, bunk bed springs, and, you know, a few other odds and ends, and started to build this really kind of a crude home fitness machine that could provide prisoners a workout while they were lying down.
I mean, that is incredible. And obviously, it feels like it must have worked because we're still talking about Pilates today. But how did this actually impact the inmates there?
Well, the morale in the camp improved, and supposedly the prisoners' overall health improved. And in 1918, a nasty case of influenza swept through England, as many of us know from our history classes. And while, of course, tons of people died from the pandemic, not a single one of Pilates' trainees succumbed to the disease. I mean, wow. That's a fact that Pilates took as clear evidence of the effectiveness of his system. So he was then buoyed by this success, and so he continued developing his techniques after he was released, and a little bit later, he made his way to the United States, and that's where his unique methods helped spark a fitness craze that was really focused on this connection between the muscle and the mind.
And the yoga pants crowd was forever grateful, I believe.
That's right.
You know? But, you know, now that we've seen how the other half exercise, what do you say we check out a couple cultural norms that have shifted social class over the years?
All right. Well, before we do that, let's take one more quick break.
Okay, Will, so one of the biggest status symbol shifts I've noticed in recent years is fashion. And there are a whole lot of movers and shakers sporting this, like, CEO casual look these days. Like, instead of the Armani suits and Gucci dresses or whatever, Silicon Valley moguls have been sporting sneakers, jeans, t-shirts, and not just at the gym, but in these professional settings and at high-profile events.
All right, so but what are you suggesting? I mean, that dressing down is being co-opted by the elite? I mean, it feels like plenty of people still dress casually, but, you know, just because the wealthy are loosening up a little doesn't mean the rest of us have to start dressing fancy, does it? Because that makes me a little bit nervous if I'm supposed to start dressing up.
No, that's definitely true. But what interested me is how different the results of dressing down are for high-status people compared to the rest of us.
Oh, what do you mean by that?
Well, think about what would happen if you wore sweatpants and a hoodie to, like, a fancy investment meeting or trying to get a mortgage or something, right? Like, you'd probably get some disapproving glances. But, you know, there are these unwritten rules and social norms that we feel compelled to go along with. And if we don't, we know it would reflect poorly on us. So we tend to pay attention to things like etiquette, dress codes, because we don't want to be excluded and we want to maintain our social standing. You know, people like you and I, like, we play by the rules as much as possible. But people with wealth and power have a lot more wiggle room when it comes to social norms. Like, they can afford to risk this disapproval that comes with wearing red sneakers to a meeting or, you know, gym clothes to a nice restaurant. And studies have shown that rather than hurting their reputation, it actually improves these people's standings, like, in the eyes of others.
That's interesting to think about. So why do you think that is? Like when Mark Zuckerberg wears jeans and a t-shirt to a meeting where everybody else is in a really fancy suit, like why would his social standing go up?
Well, it's really because of how aware we all are of the social expectations that typically, you know, someone of his wealth and influence would follow. Like, we know that he knows we expect him to dress well and behave a certain way. So when he doesn't conform, it comes off as this display of power. Like, he can afford to risk losing status by dressing down because he just has that much status to spare.
Yeah, I mean, that is interesting. But I mean, and I kind of can't believe I'm saying this, but isn't it possible we're being a little too hard on the Mark Zuckerbergs of the world? Like, who's to say he's dressing down as some kind of a power play and not just because he likes comfortable clothes?
That's fair. But, you know, whether he's bucking expectations on purpose or not, he's still reaping the benefits of this high status nonconformity, right?
Yeah.
There was this study I read about in Quartz where researchers set up all these experiments to see how nonconforming behaviors enhance the perception of status. And listen to the breakdown of what they found. So, quote, in one study, participants perceived that a guest wearing a red bow tie at a black tie country club party was a higher status member of the club and a better golf player than a conforming individual wearing a black bow tie. This assumption is based on the belief that the red bow tie wearer has enough status and autonomy to follow his preference even when they deviate from the norm. So in other words, all that matters is that the public perceives someone as choosing not to conform. And since social expectations are so ingrained, most of us assume that someone like Zuckerberg actually knows what he's doing and is subverting expectations on purpose.
You know, once you lay it all out, it reminds me of this other trend I read about where having lots of kids is now viewed as something of a status symbol because, you know, looking back in history, it's been just the opposite, really. Like the long-running stereotype is that, you know, the poor, the uneducated, they tend to have the most children while affluent couples stop at maybe one or two kids. But I was looking at this sociology professor at the University of Maryland. His name is Stephen Martin, no relation to the Steve Martin. I know he's a very talented guy, but he's not a professor there. But those trends have been gradually shifting since the late 1970s. And now the families having the most kids are those with incomes in the top 1 to 1.5%.
And so is the idea that these people are having more kids as a way to show off how rich they are?
I mean, I'm hoping that's not the main appeal of having kids for them. But I mean, just like what you were saying about public perception and casual dressing, the average person might look at a big, well-to-do family and see it as a sign of good fortune. And, you know, the inference being that parents must have plenty of time and money to go around if they choose to have so many kids. But I think the real takeaway is that it's finally time for that posh Brady Bunch remake everybody has wanted for so long. That's the main thing I've been thinking about recently.
That has to come out. Well, it is a strange thing to see, like, kids almost be seen as a status symbol, right?
Yeah, and, you know, I never would have guessed that just wearing sneakers and a hoodie into a boardroom might help you qualify as an elite. But let's go back to that term elite for just a second, if you don't mind, because I think the word itself is an interesting example of these shifting perceptions. So at the top of the show, we mentioned how it's been stretched to mean so many different things over the years. And I'd actually argue that the word has almost lost its meaning as a result of that. Like, you know, at one point, elite was just a word that meant the best or the best in a group. So it started out as kind of a generic compliment. And then over time, it came to refer specifically to people who were wealthy or influential, though not necessarily in a derogatory way, but cut to today, and that word can be used really more as a slur. Like, most people don't want to be perceived as elitist.
Yeah, I mean, elite now seems to come with that feeling of, like, not one of us. Like, squash isn't actually superior to handball or badminton or other sports. You know, it's weird and fun, but it should actually be played by everyone. And the same for lobster rolls and saison. Like, don't let people tell you that these elite things aren't for you.
Well, that's certainly a way to look at things. But for now, though, what do you say we head off to the Fact Off and share a few other shifting norms we came across this week?
Yeah, let's do it. So Ionine did this great list of things that used to be status symbols, and at the top of their list was rotting pineapples. So apparently in the 17th and 18th centuries, pineapples, and particularly like homegrown pineapples, were a massive investment. It cost about 5,000 pounds at the time. So if you had any of these fruit, you'd definitely put it on show instead of devouring it. And in fact, pineapples used to be displayed on mantles for months, just rotting there. But the best part is that if you weren't rich enough to have your own pineapple, there was a rental market for them. So you could actually pick them up for parties or just rent one for the evening.
So strange. But maybe not as strange as this fact I'm about to share. So according to the site British Path, in the Victorian era, it was actually fashionable to have rotting teeth because it showed you were rich enough to afford sugar products and confectionaries. And so this actually led to plenty of imitation, too. You would find upper-class citizens that would often paint their teeth black just to fit in or show that they were spending their money on candy, too.
So here's a quick one. Friendly x-rays just took over the world in the early 20th century, and Americans were so enamored with them that the wealthy would just like line up to get their x-ray taken. And basically seeing your own bones and owning your own personal x-ray picture became a crazy status symbol.
That's so good. All right. Well, this is from The Telegraph. Apparently when lobster became too expensive in England, it was replaced with a different ugly creature, which is the monkfish. In fact, the article states it was branded as lobster, but for the poor. And while it was considered an easy and cheap and, you know, even tasty meal for fishermen and families, the fish was actually banned in French markets because it was considered too ugly and unappetizing for display.
That's amazing. So our pal Nick Green found these great original rules for golf, and golf's obviously one of these elitist sports, but when you look back at the old rules, it actually makes the sport sound so much less civilized. And this rule is that if the player's ball strikes his adversary or his caddy, the adversary loses the hole. If it strikes his own caddy, the player loses the hole. And this is from an 1812 rule book at St. Andrew's course. So it's like a prestigious golf course. But
Right, of course.
It basically meant that if you were a ruthless player and you were good enough at aiming, you could turn golf into dodgeball with a much harder ball, of course.
I mean, that just takes the sport to another level. I think more people would watch it if they were still trying this kind of thing. For that fact, Mango, I know we've shared a lot of really fun stuff today, but I feel like that bit of rare violence from you even, Mango, talking about that is means you deserve the trophy. So congratulations.
Thank you so much. I truly appreciate it.
All right. Well, that's it for today. So from Gabe, Tristan, Mango, and me, thanks so much for listening. Thanks again for listening. Part-Time Genius is a production of How Stuff Works and wouldn't be possible without several brilliant people who do the important things we couldn't even begin to understand.
Tristan McNeil does the editing thing.
Noel Brown made the theme song and does the mixy-mixy sound thing.
Jerry Rowland does the exec producer thing.
Gabe Luzier is our lead researcher with support from the research army, including Austin Thompson, Nolan Brown, and Lucas Adams.
And Eves Jeffcoat gets the show to your ears. Good job, Eves.
If you like what you heard, we hope you'll subscribe. And if you really, really like what you've heard, maybe you could leave a good review for us.
Did we forget Jason?
Jason who?